Real families, real farms, real food. Welcome to Arizona Agriculture Connection with Maricopa County Farm Bureau. My name is Nicole Clements, Executive Director, and I'll be your host. Maricopa County Farm Bureau is the voice of agriculture in a community that thrives on the dichotomy of urban and rural agriculture operations. This podcast is a home for farmers, ranchers, food lovers, prospective agriculturalists, and those looking to connect the food on their plate with the farm that it came from. As we take an inside look at agriculture in Arizona, we will delve into topics like ag technology, policy, food preparation, and everything in between. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform with new episodes every Wednesday. Arizona Agriculture Connection is hosted by Maricopa County Farm Bureau and sponsored by Paloma Ready Mix and Materials, a proud supporter of agriculture and our communities. Be sure to subscribe and share your favorite episodes with your friends. For more interactions, follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Maricopa County FB. Now let's discover some Arizona agriculture. Well, welcome back, Arizona Aggies. My name is Nicole Clements. We're here with another episode of Arizona Agriculture Connection. And today I'm really excited to have a topic of interest for everyone, which is water in Arizona. So joining me today is Noel Carter, the general manager of the Buckeye Water Conservation and Drainage Districts, and also Stan Barnes, who's the president of Copper State Consulting Group, who also does a ton of work in water and is, you know, kind of an information hub to everybody around. So, or spiritual advisor, as I've heard also. So welcome, guys. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. I really appreciate the time, Nicole.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Nicole. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, just kick it off, Noel, why don't we start with you. Kind of what's your history? How did you wind up in irrigation districts?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. One, I didn't know some of the background about until I actually started working here. But, you know, I was born here. I ended up growing up in Oregon. I came back when I was in my early 20s. Back to Buckeye, I should say, when I was in my early 20s. And was in heavy civil construction, and I knew the previous GM here, and he called me and told me he was going on a different journey and asked if I was interested. So I applied, and somehow or another I landed the job here. And then interestingly enough, looking at the history and whatnot, I found a strong connection of my family to this district and their farming roots from clear back into the early 1900s here. So it's been quite a journey for me and understanding the history of this district. And it's been a wonderful experience and a great opportunity to serve the agricultural community here in this district. Truly blessed to be here.
Wonderful. Stan, how about you?
Yeah, I'm from Arizona. I was born in Mesa. I was raised on a farm in Pinal County. My grandfather ended up going out toward Queen Creek, but half my family is Litchfield Park and Western Maricopa County farmers. So I could have been a West Valley kid, but I ended up being an East Valley kid, which made all the difference, you know. But I got elected to the legislature when I was 27 years old. I was in the state house and the state senate, and I was the leader or chaired the committee that dealt with water and agriculture issues when I was in the state house. So I very much loved the topic. And when I left the senate way back in 1996, I did not run again, and I started Copper State Consulting Group. So I'm lucky enough to represent Noel and this district at the legislature and in other matters that impact the doings of the district and the success. So it's really a blessing to be here to talk about one of my favorite topics, really.
Awesome. 27 in the legislature. Well, that's pretty young.
They should not let people that young be in the legislature. The truth, I can tell you some scary stories about immaturity at 27. You only have to be 25, according to the state constitution. I wasn't the youngest guy ever. I was the youngest then. But there have been people that, a friend of mine was elected, and he had not yet turned 25. And they made him sit in the gallery for a few weeks until he turned 25, and then they swore him in. And that's a true story.
Wow.
Yeah, interesting stuff. But, you know, there's really nothing special about being in the legislature. You just have to be willing, and then you have to get the votes. But it's like 90 people out of the phone book, really. It's a mix of all kinds of folks. But it does lend itself to seeing a lot of big picture things and then having some impact, like on water. Very fortunate to be able to take farm childhood and to bring it into the legislature and be a part of water law in Arizona. And now, even today, talking to you, being a part of that same storyline, it's very interesting to me.
I think it's such a complicated issue, and it's such an intricate spider web of connectivity, that when you hear, you know, 30 seconds or 60 seconds about what's going on in water on the news, that just gives you not even a drop in the bucket as to what is actually happening.
There's so much history on water and how it's played out and why we are where we are today. And between surface water law and groundwater law, the prior appropriations doctrine and decreed appropriative rights adjudication, you're correct. 90 seconds of a news blurb does not help folks understand the complexity of water here in Arizona.
Yeah, I love the term whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. That there's never been more true words spoken in Arizona than that. There are attorneys that make their entire career understanding only that statute, and that's it. And it takes a combination of experience and intellect and just scar tissue of the personalities that bring it together. That one thing that was of great interest to me, a big surprise when I was young, it's still today, is so much is dependent on the personalities in the room on water. It could go this way or that way depending on the confidence and the experience and the attitude of the negotiators that are in the room making the decision about whatever is pressing at the moment.
I can't express how complicated it is, and a lot of people don't even understand, or just were never taught, that there's actually different kinds of water. So it's not just water in Arizona. It could be groundwater. It could be Colorado River water, you know. And I think just a step, so if we could, let's set a baseline, just establish what different kinds of water are there in Arizona.
So obviously you have groundwater, you've got surface water, you've got CAP water, which is coming in from the Colorado River, and then effluent is another water supply that is available. And then there's the controversial, or maybe not controversial, but just the undetermined at this point, subflow, which would be part of a surface water rights appropriation aspect. So those are the different water types, sources, supplies.
You left out an important one, and that's paper.
Ah, paper water. Yes. Oh yeah, I forget that about that one, or I choose not to talk about it. It frustrates me.
So for those listening who may not understand what paper water means, can you give us a definition?
Noel would be better at giving that definition.
Oh, I don't know if I'd be better. I get frustrated about it. But in the early 90s, when the CAP was bringing water in, there needed to be some level of benefit to get this water. You know, there was the GRD was created. Stan, jump in here if I get
you're
this
using
wrong.
Acronyms already.
The GRD. So it's the Central Arizona Groundwater Conservation District. Thank you.
Yeah, the replenishment district is what it's called. The replenishment district. Paper water is water that exists underground, and it's an accounting of that and who owns that water. Noel was on the right track, of course. But years ago, when we first got the Central Arizona Project completed and our allocation for Arizona from the Colorado River, we could not use all the water. There was so much water, we could not use it all. And we were afraid that if we didn't use it, we would lose it. And that California, the great state of California, with all its federal power, would somehow take that water. And the big thinkers of the day knew that if we would need that water someday. So they felt like the way to do it was to use it today in the manner you started to describe. They brought it uphill through the CAP and put it underground in Arizona and stored it in Arizona. We were taking water that is Arizona's allocation and putting it underground just so California wouldn't get it in the long game. And when you look back on it 30 years, now you realize how smart that was, given the drought that is here and the thirst of California and our own thirst. So when people say paper, people say in water world, wet, they have to say wet water at times when you're having a discussion. I mean wet water, not paper water. That means I mean water that is underground or that is flowing to me legally versus water that is in someone's accounting system somewhere that they think they own that is stored underground that no one has seen that water in a very long time. Is that close?
Yes. Yeah. And to that point, one of the problems with this, though, is that it incentivized that water use in areas that didn't historically have a water supply. You know, North Phoenix, Anthem, areas that were able to get this paper water that was put in the ground to develop. It took the value away from the lands that had the water. And it created an issue with a promise of the 1980 Groundwater Management Act, which was these agricultural lands would have a conversion rate of 3.5 acre feet per acre. Well, all of this that happened in the early 90s with the CAP changed that. And you'd have to get with somebody smarter than I about all the intricacies of that, but that has been one of the big issues up here. So all this water went to areas that didn't historically have a surface water right or have the access to the groundwater that in order to be able to build. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true too. I mean, there's variations of paper water as well. To make your grand point of how complicated the water topic is. But back in the day, and exists to this day, you must show 100-year water supply in order to develop in an active management area. And sometimes that 100-year supply was located in La Paz County or in Harquahala County, or Harquahala area. And a city like the city of Mesa owned a bunch of land in Pinal County. And so when the city built houses in Mesa, with the current water supply it had, because it had the capacity, the law said, where is your 100-year supply? And the city of Mesa said, it's over there in Pinal County. Right now, the Wirtzes are farming on it, but it's our water. And that is paper water. That's water that Mesa's not actually using, but is using only for legal purposes to point at and say, we have water, it's just over there. In the meantime, we have plenty of water right now, just through the systems we've got. So there is this long game, short game, what is underground, what is flowing, what's coming down the river, what might fall through precipitation. It's a beautiful story of complications, but it's supporting 7 million people in Arizona, and we're using less of it today than we did 60 years ago when there was only 2 million people in Arizona. So it's a good story as well.
You know, as someone who coming from the Midwest, where we typically don't have these issues, right? We most of the time have way too much water right along the Missouri River. Learning this, and even as coming from someone in agriculture and who has, you know, dealt with agriculture issues before and water in a sense, but not water like Arizona water. It's extremely complicated. It's hard to understand. And I think it's hard to convey some of that importance about where do we designate water or who do we designate water to, who gets that priority. And, you know, a lot of people have opinions about it and it's hard to maybe decipher what is the most important thing for Arizona. And I think that's probably always our big question.
So to that point, that is one of the big things about adjudications that's so important in this state. And it's a point that is very forefront on our radar here at this district because of all of the water issues that we are trying to work out currently right now between water that has been captured and used upstream out of priority. We've made agreements on some of those, and I can get into this, you know, throughout the podcast here, but we've made permanent agreements on some of those, and some of them we have not. Some of them are temporary. Some of them we haven't settled. And with all of the water issues that we're seeing between, you know, the cuts that are going to happen on the Colorado fight, Bartlett Dam, well, in technical name would be the Verde River sediment study. You know, those are big issues that we see as water constrictions. Or it's going to harm us down here with our historic water rights. So we're trying to work through all those right now. So there's big issues on, you know, the moratorium of groundwater pumping right now for development, surface water, paper water, and the CAP. It's a big tangled web.
Yeah, you'd think after, you know, over 100 years of statehood, perhaps we'd have all the wrinkles run out and it would be smooth, but it's not in any way at all. there is foundational law. There are big settlements that have happened with tribes, for instance, and with other cities. And we've done a lot. We've made a lot of progress. But as Noel said, there are still yet big water issues in front of us. And it is all underlaid by this, that we get 7 inches of rain a year or something like that in the Salt River Valley. And yet we have 5 million people, and every day more people come. And somehow we're making it all go. And that is nothing simple about that. God causes snow and rain to fall in the White Mountains that eventually comes down the Salt and Verde Rivers and is stored. And that simple statement affects Buckeye downriver that was here first and predated all of that. But yet all of that happened upstream, and it impacts Buckeye. Everything, what I have taught myself when it comes to the water as a subject, is that you cannot touch the topic without affecting everything. There's no such thing as we're just going to do this little thing over here when it comes to water law, or even some sort of settlement or negotiation or handshake. Whatever you do, it's already been allocated and pressurized and stretched politically. And so whatever you touch, everyone feels the vibration and everyone wants in on the conversation. And so it's very difficult to get 3 people in a room and make a decision. There needs to be 30 people in the room because everybody's got a stake in that decision.
Very well put.
You see that? That's how I get the term spiritual advisor.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Do you think, which I've heard 200 people a day are moving to Maricopa County. Do you think that is your largest obstacle, is the influx of people with a lack of history and ties to Arizona trying to understand the water topic?
I think our largest obstacle, honestly, is the ongoing drought.
Yes.
Yeah, the new guy doesn't, all he does is create some demand, but we can meet that demand. But the drought, what's the single biggest problem in Arizona water?
I completely agree with that.
Right? Yep. Mm-hmm. It affects the Colorado River, and greatly, which all affects all of population center of Arizona.
Exactly. So if you think about what Stan just talked about, the drought affects the Colorado River, which then affects us. So in response to that effect, modified Bartlett Dam. And the trickle down on that is more stored water upstream, which takes our natural flood flow decreed water rights and stores them up there and cuts them off down here, restricts our flow. And that, so everything plays a factor. And when you have a drought in it, it is probably, to Stan's point, the one single biggest issue with water here.
I know if we were to somehow go back, you know, the drought's been going on for over 20 years. If we were to go back in our wet years of the late 70s, early 80s type of thing, I mean, a lot of problems would be resolved, and including the way it expands into the regular world, the not water world, because the constraint on water plays out in the newspapers on the East Coast and in other places, and money and development worries that Arizona doesn't have the water. And so that money and development looks for perhaps another place to invest. And so one of the grand things to understand about is the water relates directly to the economy and the jobs that come in order for those 200 people a day in Maricopa County. It's not just drinking water or bathing water. It is really all about how the economy grows and how we sustain managing all the people that are moving here.
It's very interesting, for sure. So we talk about water year round in Arizona, but specifically this week we're talking irrigation districts and water because it's National Irrigation District Month, which I was not aware was an actual holiday.
I was not aware of that either.
So we're all learning something. Yeah, take the day off. Yeah. So in the spirit of the holidays, what can you speak to a little bit? What is an irrigation district and how does it play into kind of the water story?
Well, irrigation districts, you know, are primarily to support the district in which the boundaries are light or are established for that district. We support them in the irrigation of their crops. Our district and some of the other districts that I know of, we allocate the water based on supply availability. We schedule the water for the farmers when they call it in, when they need that supply. We also irrigate residential homes, and some irrigation districts supply municipal supplies. There's a statute that says if you didn't supply municipal water prior to June or July of 1977, then you can't supply municipal water after that. You can be a wholesaler to a municipal supplier. But it's all based off of water rights, what the land has a right to, whether it's groundwater, whether it's surface water, or a combination thereof. And so we track that. We report it to ADWR, the consumption, what we send to them, the deliveries that we make to each of those fields, to those parcels of land. Our district, we supply power to our customers as well. We're irrigation and electrical district. And we are tasked with maintaining the system in which we deliver the infrastructure. So we're governed by a board of directors that are elected by the folks within our district. And we report to our board of directors and they make all the decisions. Stan, would you add anything else?
Yeah, I think you started at the 102 level, but the 101 level is it's a subdivision of the state of Arizona.
Good point. Yes.
It's a legal creature of the legislature. And Buckeye, for instance, was formed under that statute over 100 years ago?
Yes. Yeah. The Buckeye Water Conservation Drainage District was established in 1922.
So there you go, over 100 years ago. Yeah. And so you say, why is there such a thing? It was because, I think, I wasn't there obviously, but individual landowners and farmers had a collective goal. And they were all the better working together than any one person trying to dredge a canal or create a canal or dam the river or any other thing that meant an improvement of the water system for everybody to benefit. And so the district was created as a legal framework to get everyone to work together toward the same goal under the same rules, so that you didn't have dozens of people doing dozens of different things and then fighting over whose water was what and why and that infrastructure, who owned it and who needs to manage it and everything else. It's a collective to the benefit of all the landowners.
Right.
Because they had something in common.
So to that point, our canal system, our infrastructure was actually established in 1885, and it was operated under a non-irrigation type district. It was a ditch company, a bucket irrigation company. And so there was a need for that district type legal ability to operate the system in a better manner and to maintain it, to be able to have the government, like municipal statutory authorities, to help maintain and manage and assess the lands to afford to effectively or efficiently manage the system. So that's what, and we had some unique situations out here that really drove that. But it did, as Stan said, it allowed us to maintain the system better, to build a new diversion structure and better operate the system in a more effective and efficient manner and bring everybody towards that common goal.
Yeah, if it didn't exist, it'd be kind of like the Wild West. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm going to take it and you got to stop me type of thing. This gave the framework for everybody to work together and develop water resources to the benefit of good of the whole. And they have a tenure in Arizona that predates a lot of things. I mean, over 100 years old is a pretty good thing. It's older than a lot of cities in Arizona. And the water rights that come with it are older than most people understand. And so it's a very important legal thing. But it mainly is to benefit those living in the district, because the water, it's nature doing its thing, and without mankind manipulating that water to the benefit of mankind, it is just going to flow down the river. So the district is formed to facilitate all of that. Mm-hmm. How's that sound?
That's
that
perfect.
Good?
Yep.
So where does the water come from that Buckeye Water District distributes?
So we have a decreed water right. I shouldn't say our district. The lands within our district are what the beneficiaries of the decree are, and they are all listed within the decree. So within that decree, we have our supplies come from the Gila River, Salt River, Verde River, and the Olafurria River. Those all fall under our surface water right supplies and decree. We also have most all of the lands within our district, 99.9% of the lands within our district have irrigation grandfathered rights, or IGFRs. So they have the ability to use groundwater, and they have the ability to use surface water. And so we supplement our surface water supply that has been hindered upstream with groundwater, which there's a, I'm not going to get into this because it will really make, probably confuse people even more, but it's, there's an aspect of that that's a subflow region of our supplies that would be part of our surface water rights operation. So that would be, you know, certain elevation below ground surface that would be attributed to surface water, to the river. It's a hydrologic connection to the river that we assert as our part of our surface water supply through our.
Do you see the impact of how fast these communities are growing, Buckeye being one of them, that's kind of doing this rapid expansion? Does that impact how you operate as a district?
Right now, no. I mean, there is some impacts on us with development and whatnot, but we are trying to look to the future on that so that we are ready for that when it happens. We are working with the city of Buckeye on how that looks in the future, working out agreements with them for supplying the surface water appropriative right to those lands through the city of Buckeye, being we would deliver the water to the city would treat it and then deliver it to the pertinent lands. So we're working on that. Our district is probably going to develop a little bit slower than the rest of the city of Buckeye as a whole. But we had some great legislation, thanks to Mr. Barnes here, that we ran two sessions ago.
Right.
It made it through, it landed on the governor's desk, and she signed it. And we're really appreciative of the legislature and the governor for passing that law, because for the first time ever, a city is able to have a single carved out designation of assured water supply just within our district boundaries based on our surface water rights. And I say ours, meaning the water rights that are decreed to the lands in our district, because the right runs with the land. So that's a really big benefit for the city. And once we are able to finalize all of these agreements that we are working on, discussions and working on trying to get all these settlements accomplished with all the upstream folks, we will be able to use that for the city of Buckeye as a designation of assured water supply within our district, which at that point in time would be, that's when we would really start seeing the development occur. I'm not sure that the ag to urban, which I think we're going to touch on here a little bit, is going to be the driver for development within our district. But it will help with other districts in the city out here in Buckeye.
So for clarification, what piece of legislation are you referring to?
I don't remember the bill number that we ran, but it is now 576-10. If I remember correctly.
So that's the statute said?
That's the statute, yeah. So that was a really good piece of legislation for us. And once we get everything kind of settled upstream, it will be very beneficial for the city of Buckeye within our district boundary.
Yeah, and you asked, is what the growth is happening, what impact is that having on the district? And that's, Noel's touched on it. That bill was passed anticipating that the city of Buckeye needs water to facilitate the growth. Mm-hmm. And the bill allowed the city to do something no other city has done, and that is, in all the big city jurisdiction, which Buckeye is a very large city, in this specific portion, the boundaries of the Buckeye Water Conservation Drainage District, in that area, the city can say, we have an assured water supply at a certain level. And that simplicity is a very big breakthrough in water law for a providing city like Buckeye. Up until this point, Buckeye had to say we have it for the whole city or none type of thing. Now the Buckeye, the city, has this one jurisdiction, which means growth can happen there that really couldn't happen before, and Buckeye can serve that growth in the most efficient manner. So the district is changing laws in order to facilitate the growth we know is coming. A lot of the decisions Knowles elected board are making today are based on the pressure we know of new population and land development within the district. We're not going to be farming 100 years from now like we're farming right now. And so the decisions by the board are trying to anticipate that phenomenon that's coming.
So kind of leading into that, what is agri-urban? What does that look like kind of in definition, and what does it look like in implementation?
Well, agri-urban provides an opportunity for those that have agricultural lands that are in the agricultural industry to, when they're ready, to sell their land for development based on a conversion rate of their irrigation grandfathered right. So they can take their IGFR and that's tied to that land, and they can sell it to a developer who could then convert it over for a certificate of water right, of assured water right.
Yeah, it's a way, it's a bigger picture way.
Right.
It's a bigger story than like the one we just told about the bill that Buckeye ran two sessions ago. It is a new law to facilitate the growth demand that is here. The previous law was limiting the ability of development to take place based on lack of water. The new law sets a formula for how ag lands get that water gets used, sold, transferred into development world. And the big rub was, what is that formula going to look like? Because there's a conservative political element that wants to make it all happen and lots of water now for development. And then there's another philosophy that is trying to limit growth under the idea that we don't have the water in the very long term. So those two forces are represented by our Democratic governor, who has one approach, and our Republican legislature, who has another approach. They had to come together in a happy medium about what is reasonable in the way of ag land water becoming development water, and what is real and not real, what will last 100 years or at least anyone's lifetime. Those are big decisions, and everyone at the table coming up with the answer for that was doing their part and playing the role of that they were designed to play, presenting their constituencies. It was really a very big breakthrough. Mm-hmm. In the end, what's going to happen is the 200 people coming to Maricopa County every year, every day, like you suggested, there'll be a better way to facilitate that with new housing and that is necessary to support where those people are going to live. So it's a very big breakthrough, and everyone deserves to pat themselves on the back for compromising and making the right decision on it. It's not easy for political figures to compromise in the modern world. I think it's stating the obvious, we're very polarized as a nation and as a state also. And when you have one branch of government that is one philosophy and another branch is another, it's difficult to come together. Sometimes it's just easier to point fingers and blame somebody and then run that way in the election. And try to, you know, change the game. But in this case, adults came to the table and made good decisions. Arizona development benefits, Arizona agriculture benefits, and it's wise water use as well. So it's not crazy. It's the biggest thing since the Groundwater Management Act, mm-hmm. or at least one of the biggest things. There's some number of big things, but before 1980, it was the Wild West. And the Wild West eventually was going to lead to a lot of problems, a lot of shortage, a lot of infighting, a lot of fighting, period. And 1980, adults came together, bipartisan, Democratic Governor Bruce Babbitt, Republican legislature, and created a formula for how we manage our groundwater. And it was the thing that allowed us to have water today and serve 5 million people in Maricopa County. Responsibly. this ag to urban is the next big echo of that. It's in the same flavor of what it does to account for reality underground and what that water means and how it can sustain in the future. The details are really important, but the punchline is everyone benefits because we have a formula based on reality about wet water use, not paper water, wet water.
So I think a lot of times when we hear about this legislature that's passed and, you know, this is a great opportunity for, you know, a great compromise, as you said, sometimes what gets left out is maybe the implementation of it. What is the implementation of this legislation look like on a day-to-day basis from a boots-on-the-ground kind of perspective? Do you see, you know, any challenges from that side of it as far as, you know, the irrigation districts or whoever will be kind of implementing this rule?
I think under the Ag to Urban, there are some things that need to probably be addressed. And I think that there might be an opportunity next year to address some of these things as far as for the implementation aspect. I've had multiple conversations with the city of Buckeye regarding the Ag to Urban. I don't think it's going to be a real challenging issue for the implementation on this. I think that there's some aspects on it as far as the, based on the availability of supply, where that measurement is coming from. That is based on a agricultural well that is supplying water to that land. In our district, our wells, the district wells, are what supply that water to the land. So if you're looking for a conversion of the IGFR on a specific land that is maybe a mile from where that well is, or the culmination of wells are that deliver to that land. So you're looking way over here at what that availability is from that well. You know, I think that there's some things that we need to work on how that formula is played out. Dan, I don't know if you can help me kind of explain what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah, I think what you're trying to say is now there's new rules in the game and the marketplace will follow those rules. The marketplace of land buyers and sellers, developers that are seeking to supply housing for all the people that are coming. What's going to happen is farmers are going to make deals. This not today, but over the next few years and decades, farmers are going to make deals on their lands with developers that would not have happened otherwise. And so the mechanics of how that plays out really are just to understand the invisible hand of the marketplace. Developers will say what can or cannot be done, and landowners will say what can or cannot be done. Look at the rules, and the Department of Water Resources is the enforcer of those rules, our state regulator, and there will be formulas and rulemaking and perhaps changes in order to accommodate unexpected things. But I think you know, if you step away from it and look down on it, you say, well, what is the implementation? There's a new rule book in the very big game of Arizona development. And all the sophisticated money, lawyers, entrepreneurs, ambitious people that are buying and selling and doing to accommodate all this growth have a new way to play the game. And that new way should facilitate all of this. So there is an umpire in the Department of Water Resources, but there is no center. There's no one person in charge or something. There is only the marketplace of people that own land and water rights and people that want to develop land and need water in order to develop.
There's going to be some questions that are brought up. There's going to be, you know, challenges, I believe, with the implementation. You know, I think that In this situation, this is where irrigation districts and cities it's really important for them to work together to bring the implementation of this to fruition. Without that, it's going to make it more challenging. And that's why we've established such a good relationship with the city of Buckeye to work through all of these potential implementation challenges. So as far as boots on the ground aspect of it, you know, until we get in the thick of it, I'm not really sure what those are going to be.
Kind of a learning curve, just like with anything.
Absolutely.
For sure. Kind of on this trend of really complicated topics that are shown in brief clips on the news.
Yes.
So recently we've seen and correct me if I'm wrong, a transfer of water to Queen Creek to support kind of what they've got going on there. Can you guys speak to kind of what that actually was and, you know, how they're going to continue to utilize that?
It's a fun story, and I'll make it very quick, but after the Groundwater Management Act, when that paper water idea was created, where cities were buying farmland in other faraway places and saying, there's our water, while they grew locally and pointing to somewhere else, rural Arizona became rightfully afraid that someday Phoenix Metropolitan and even Tucson Metropolitan were going to come to rural Arizona and take the water, and rural Arizona be left with nothing. And there were some really bad examples of that happening in California and other places. So that was politically untenable. So adults came to the table back in 1991, the cities, the agriculture, and everyone that's involved in water, from mining to industry, you name it. And they said, we need a new set of laws to deal with this rural to urban transfer that was caused by the Groundwater Management Act, because we knew it couldn't last the way it was. So what came out of all that negotiation was a new law that set aside, that did away with rural to urban transfer. You can't do that except for three very important places. And there was one added later, but three very important places. Harquahala was one of them. There's two others in the Far West Valley as well, Butler Valley and McMullen Valley. Those three hydrologically separate basins, one of which is in Maricopa County, Harquahala area, were set aside legally in 1991. So water in that basin could be lifted out of the ground and transferred to where it's needed in urban Phoenix Metro or Tucson or Pinal County. And it's easy to transfer it, but I say easy. There is a mechanism to physically transfer wet water through the Central Arizona Project. That water can be lifted out of the ground in Harquahala, pumped uphill and put in the canal, and then flowed to Buckeye or Queen Creek or whatever other city wanted to pay to have that water. So the story you referenced at the beginning of this portion is the decision by the governor of Arizona, to which she gets great credit, to allow, to permit the Harquahala landowners to lift groundwater out of the ground, to clean it to a certain standard, put it in the Central Arizona Project, and sell that water to the thirsty and growing cities like Queen Creek and Buckeye, which are the first two cities to step up and to take advantage of that 1991 statute that I happen to be a part of so long ago. So when you read about it, it's not just Queen Creek, it's Buckeye. And they're actually equals. They're both buyers. They're both cities that need water that don't have water. They're both cities that have growth that don't know what they're going to do to manage that growth, but they know they need water. Where they're going to get at least some of that water is from Harquahala. And that breakthrough of the final permitting and permission and money transfer, those cities are paying a great deal. The taxpayers in those cities are paying a great deal of money for that water. And the landowners in Harquahala are paying a great deal of money for the infrastructure to get it out of the ground, cleaned up, and in the canal. And I might add, the state of Arizona is a part of it. There's state trust land out there. And those state trust lands, again, this is in Maricopa County and the Harquahala portion, those state trust lands are the revenue from those lands benefit the public schools. And the state of Arizona, through that state trust land development, is a part of the Harquahala water transfer. So there's really a lot of good news in this story. Buckeye gets water, indeed. Same with Queen Creek. And the landowners in Harquahala are going to grow less alfalfa and less cotton and are going to use some of that water for a higher value, if you will, in the marketplace, not to mention to accommodate the growth. And while I'm at it, some of those same farmers out there that have been suffering with cotton prices that have been just in the ditch for decades are now growing electricity. with solar panels on the land instead of a cotton field. And that those solar panels are being used to run the lights in this room as we speak. So there's changes happening in Maricopa County to agriculture that are interesting. And landowners that have been farming for generations in some portions are now using water for a higher value and land for a higher value than they have been in the past.
Almost diversifying their portfolio.
Yes, you don't even have to say almost. They are diversifying. And in many cases, it's saving the family farm. I mean, be that dramatic about it. Mm-hmm. Now, there's the interesting part about all this Harquahala transfer is that it's 35 years in the making, really. And when in 1991, when I was a young legislator and we were thinking about water transfer, no one knew when the day might come, but no one also really predicted the level of growth coupled with the drought, the growth, hyper growth in Maricopa County. And you might add in Pinal and Pima County as well, the thirsty desert areas of Arizona, along with a drought no one's seen ever in our lifetime. Those two factors have made this water transfer basin even more important. One of the key things, if it's not clear through all of these words I'm using, is that it's a 100-year supply. It's not just tomorrow. It's the next century of water use for Buckeye and Queen Creek. It's not all of Buckeye's water. It's not all of Queen Creek's water, but it's a significant portion, and it's deemed by the Department of Water Resources as solid for 100 years. And I'm going to add only to a certain level of depth to groundwater. The law only allows you to pump so much water. But there is more water further, hydrologically speaking, but the law doesn't allow for that. So there, even as we're doing this, we're doing it responsibly. There's something very important for Arizona to brag about. We get kicked around for, you know, being last in education or something and that sort of thing. And some of the things we deserve to be kicked around for, but one of the things we do not deserve to be kicked around for, and we deserve accolades, is water policy. Really forward thinking and accommodating all these millions of people with air conditioning and houses and jobs in the desert. Harquahala is playing a part of that. In the future, McMullen and Butler Valley will play a part of that. But it's part of the puzzle piece, along with everything Knoll's doing and other irrigation districts and the Salt River Project and cities and agriculture all over Maricopa County. Everybody's in at some level to manage the big water picture, and everybody's playing their part. And there's money involved, and there's future money involved. I mean, this idea of accommodating growth and value of land and value of crops versus value of housing and all that other stuff. I mean, when I was a kid growing up here, I contemplated, you know, staying on the family farm kind of thing. One of the things I learned in the legislature in my 20s was that there was a certain, not planning, but anticipating that in Maricopa County, agriculture was going to yield to urbanization. And indeed that, I mean, and now it's been 35 years since I was in the legislature, indeed that's happening. Queen Creek, where I'm from, where I grew up, now looks like, you know, a giant suburb, which it is. And Buckeye, which was a sleepy farm town, is now on its path to be the biggest city in Arizona, even surpassing Phoenix in the next century, because it has all this land and all these people that want to come here. And so watching agriculture in Maricopa County change and evolve and eventually yield to the pressures of urbanization is just one of the phenomena we're all living with. It's not a good or a bad thing. It just is. And there are a lot of people making great money on it. And there's a lot of people, I think, kind of nostalgic about it. It'd be nice that Buckeye could be a sleepy farming town forever and ever, but that's just not the way humanity goes, especially in the high growth state of Arizona. Mm-hmm. Get me off my soapbox, Noah, please.
No, you're absolutely right. I'll tell you, to that point, though, that is probably one of the hardest things that I have to discuss with my board of directors that are agricultural leaders out here in this district, is the the future of ag not being here. That is a, these families, these board members are fifth generation farmers, if not, you know, older. You know, one of my board members that retired from my board a few years ago, he's had a member of his family on this board since 1908. Well, the previous, the Buck Irrigation Company
right,
board, but
right.
You know, you gotta include both those. The chairman of my board, you know, that gentleman is, Mr. Gladden, is an amazing man. I mean, he's 92 this August, I think it is. And, you know, they've been farming here for many decades. And in Harcohela, he farmed in Harcohela, and they were the pinnacle founders of their families of this land. And so talking to them about this is very challenging. But I think that they see the writing on the wall. They see the change that is coming, but they know, and so they are doing everything that they can to make sure that the agricultural community is prepared through legislation, through being participating in these bills, these laws, to afford the ability for this agricultural community to benefit from the change from ag to urban. I think that's a really important aspect for the agricultural community here, to be a part of changing of the change and what that looks like. So
it's a tough conversation.
It is.
Especially, you know, as Farm Bureau, we want to preserve and protect every acre of ag land.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. And as a generational farmer myself, like it is very nostalgic that you have a piece of yourself there. So it becomes, you know, also an emotionally charged conversation. But I think what we try to balance is, you know, how do we continue operating and how do we work together with the urbanization? Because it's here and it's not going anywhere. So how do we continue agriculture production working in harmony with our urban areas? And I think that it's a conversation we have almost every day, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's really important because it's almost a, you want to stick your head in the sand and not really talk about it. Because it's a really tough topic to talk about.
It is.
And again, that emotional connection, you know, it's tough to see some of this stuff go.
Yeah, it's not a normal industry. It is the foundational industry. And anyone in it is generally born into it, and it's just part of their family. And so it's not like I was born in the city, went to college, and then went to a farm. It's generally not the path. It's the whole of the way around. And it's a life. Everyone knows it's a life. It's a 7-day week life. It's not a plug and play. It's not you don't take a lot of time off, right? I mean, it's unlike any other industry.
The way I see it, a farmer is a God-appointed steward of the land, and they do everything they can to care for the land, grow the crops that support the growth, the nutrition, the what folks need to live, and I've seen people that have tried to do a stance ed, grew up in the city, went to college, went and bought a farm. They weren't a farmer for very long. And there's probably some that have made it in that aspect. But again, these are generational farmers. These are folks that have been God appointed to care for this great land, and they've done it well.
I think we see an influx currently of people wanting to get into agriculture. And now where we're at with, you know, average person is 5 generations removed from the farm.
Yeah.
And now they want to get back to it. And so that's another episode topic entirely. But how do we kind of mentor these people into agriculture that don't have that connection? And that is another extremely difficult task and topic, but you know, we see that as well. And I get calls at Farm Bureau almost, I would say, weekly of people looking for resources and information. And how do I, even if it's something small, right? We see a lot of urban agriculture in Maricopa County. So how do we connect these people with the land and with their food and help them kind of foster this connection that they has been lost to them for decades and decades.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
Yeah, it's a very hard thing these days. It's a challenging question. But.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I want to thank you guys for all your time today. This was absolutely a fantastic conversation. Hopefully clear as mud.
Yeah, I would like to add one thing here to close out with, if you don't mind. And that is to remind everybody why this valley is so great. If it wasn't for the agricultural community developing the facilities to deliver this water, to develop this water, being the Salt River Project, all the different irrigation and ditch companies that developed that land for agriculture use, that had a general obligation bond on all their land to build the dams upstream, this valley wouldn't be what it is today. And so, you know, I give great thanks to the agricultural community for what their foresight, their vision was for this valley. They saw a potential, they had a great vision, and they were able to work their tails off and bond their land as collateral to build infrastructure that has made what we have today possible. So
no, you can't say it enough. If you're not from Arizona, even if you are, you may not appreciate what it took and how relatively new it all is, really. I mean, the farm I grew up on, Pinnell, there were five owners of the land before my grandfather. And if you don't count God the Almighty who made it, the Native Americans, the Spanish, the Mexican government, the federal government of the United States, the state of Arizona, and Les Barnes. And that's the history of that land in six fingers, which is kind of a special thing. And to drive the point home, the little farmhouse where I grew up on is gone as a Chick-fil-A there now. And that's what's happening all over Maricopa County, is the people came here and they you know, they just lived it and busted tail in order to take raw desert and make it livable. And so more people could come, and it just keeps on feeding itself with people doing this. And without it, there wouldn't be anywhere to move to. It would just flood all the time, and then there'd be no water at all, and it would be untenable. But the big risk takers, as Noel said, mortgaged all their land, lived completely full of debt their whole lives, making it all go, passing it to the next generation for their turn to roll the rock uphill. Right. It's just an amazing thing to watch. And if you're, you know, it's those things are lost to us as we urbanize nationally, as we urbanize in Arizona. And, you know, and a guy moves to Chandler and he's from the East Coast and he works at Intel and he has no real idea how it all got to be here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, thanks to Maricopa County Farm Bureau and for, you know, keeping the story alive, because it does matter. And it's good to see everybody going to chicken coops in the backyard again, right? I mean, there is a return to the realization about where it all comes from. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I could go on.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic. And, you know, we're just grateful for the opportunity to tell the stories and get them out there.
Thank you for putting it out there.
But Noel, Stan, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us today. Again, great conversation and hopefully educational clarification, and also just being able to tell the story about why we're all here today.
Well, thank you.
All right. Join us next week for another AgriPort edition of Arizona Agriculture Connection.
Thank you for tuning in today. And remember, Farm Bureau has a place for you. Be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with your friends on socials. You can also visit our website, MaricopaCountyFB.org, for more information and to submit a topic you want to learn about. Remember to tune in every Wednesday wherever you listen to podcasts. A huge thank you to Paloma Ready Mix and Materials for supporting our agriculture producers and this podcast. Maricopa County Farm Bureau, bringing you the stories of real families, real farms, and real food. I'm Nicole Clements, signing off. Catch you next week.